Ha huagestig ri CGSF, nached poing aun FM, crawl over Burnaby, British Columbia.
Making contact.
You're listening to Making Contact. I'm Lucy Kang. The United States is the world's fourth biggest exporter of coal. And a good chunk of our coal, about 14%, comes from West Virginia. It's transported by train from those mines to ports on the East Coast, including the Port of Virginia, which is the country's largest coal exporting hub. There, millions of tons of coal are stored in open-air piles, which means all that coal dust just blows onto nearby communities in the Hampton Roads region, including historic Black neighborhoods. It's well known that coal dust causes serious health problems. Crosswinds is a podcast miniseries brought to us by the Repair Lab at the University of Virginia, and it dives into this issue through the lens of environmental racism. To tell the story, the producer of the series, Adrian Wood, collaborated with activists and community members who are working to hold these companies accountable. I'll let them explain more.
Crosswinds is an investigative audio documentary about coal dust air pollution in the Hampton Roads region of Virginia that follows the relationships between people who are living in that area and their relationships with each other, with the air pollution problem, and with the forces that sustain their movement for clean and healthy living.
So why did you decide to make Crosswinds and look at the issues of coal dust pollution and environmental racism?
Yeah. So with the Repair Lab, we work together as a group of academics, activists, and artists on issues of environmental racism. The work that the Repair Lab does is fueled around and centered around the advocacy of our activists and residents who this cycle brought to us their concerns about clean air in their community in Hampton Roads. So what I do as a multimedia producer is centered around their advocacy and their concerns. And I work to create narratives that support the changes that they're seeking in their communities.
So we're about to listen to an excerpt from episode 3, which is called Cost. Can you set that episode up for us and explain how it ties into the larger arc of the series?
Yeah. Episode 3, Cost, is sort of a historical look at the relationships between the railroad industry, the coal industry, and the history of African-American labor in the United States, and particularly in Virginia. And it starts out with a story about John Henry, who is an American mythological figure who potentially was a real person who worked on a railroad that connects the coal fields of Appalachia to the coal export terminals in Hampton Roads. And it's not just the train tracks that connect those communities. They're also drawn together by their shared concerns about air pollution and other kinds of pollution that come along with the coal and rail industries. The episode goes on to look at other places that have been affected by coal dust air pollution and what those effects have been like in those communities, what advocacy has been like, and how those communities have come together around the issues of coal dust air pollution.
You know, something that really struck me about your series is just how, like, it seems to use this model of journalism where it works directly with activists and other people who are impacted. And I'm wondering how you think that compares to a more conventional model of journalism where there's more of a division in the name of, like, quote unquote, objectivity.
For me, it made sense to align myself with the protagonists of the series because our goal is clean air. And that is something that we have not just as like a professional goal, but a goal that is aligned with continued life for human beings in this region. So there's not really like another side to that for me. And I see that as part of the goal of the series and the goal of the story that we're telling is to support the lives of the people who we're reporting with. And I think that ideally my role is more collaborative with those communities, reflecting on how they would like their words to be expressed, how they would like their context to be presented to people who will probably never meet them. The Crosswind series has been shortlisted for a journalism prize, the Press Gazette New Media Storytelling Prize that they do every year. So that's a huge achievement for us. And I think that goes to show that non-traditional methods of reporting can offer something to journalism as a field, as well as to the communities that they represent.
Well, Adrian, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me on Making Contact. We're so excited to share part of Crosswinds with our listeners.
Thanks for your great questions, Lucy.
That's Adrian Wood. They're a multimedia producer with the University of Virginia's Repair Lab and the producer of Crosswinds. Here's an excerpt from episode 3. Cost.
John Henry went up on the mountain, and the mountain was so tall. Well, the mountain was so tall, and John Henry was so small. Well, the red hammer down, and he cried,
Lord, Lord.
Well, he laid his hammer down.
It's a classic American tale, a race between John Henry and a steam drill. The challenge? Tunneling through a mountain, constructing a railroad that would reach from coal country to Virginia's coasts. At the end of the story, he died with a hammer in his hand. John Henry is often depicted as a hero, but the story is much more complex. This 1947 recording is sung by incarcerated laborers working on a railroad in Mississippi. It's from the Library of Congress's Lomax Archive. Our journey begins with John Henry's story, when coal was first chiseled out of Appalachia. John Henry's tale is about his life and his labor and his death, but it's also about the foundations of the coal and rail industries as they fused together in the midst of the Industrial Revolution. Like many myths, John Henry's story is rooted in reality. John Henry was very likely a real person, a Black man living in Virginia in the 1870s. While we don't have documents that can pinpoint John Henry the individual, given the time period, John Henry was likely a veteran of the Union forces. Lots of Black Union veterans ended up in Virginia at the end of the Civil War in 1865, at a time when Virginia, along with the rest of the South, was inventing new laws to criminalize Blackness.
What we see during this era of sort of the 13th Amendment, it's illegal to enslave people unless they were duly convicted of something. We see this growth in Black code, the illegality attached to people solely for being Black.
That is Alexis Harris, a sociologist and presidential term professor at the University of Washington. Black codes were new laws designed to control Black people by convicting them for so-called offenses like loitering, breaking curfew, vagrancy, having weapons, and not carrying proof of employment.
There weren't physical prisons at that time and large scale. And so people's bodies, just like in slavery, were leased out to private entities to extract wealth, to extract their labor, to literally extract the lives from these individuals.
Even though the slave economy had collapsed, Virginia and other southern states found a workaround to have a pool of forced labor. This was called the convict lease system, and it was deadly.
Virginia was in a lot of debt after the Civil War, so the Commonwealth leased convicts to build the railroads that fueled the Industrial Revolution. 9 out of 10 convict laborers were African American. Almost all of them worked on the railroad. In 1872, half of all penitentiary deaths were due to rail work, mostly due to lung disease, silicosis that came from tunneling through mountains. John Henry was likely among those killed by the convict lease system working on the railroad in Virginia. The railroad these men built now connects West Virginia's coal fields to Virginia's ports in Hampton Roads. Their labor created the infrastructure that shaped the foundations of the coal industry in these two states. Forced labor didn't just fuel Virginia's coal industry. Convicts were leased to work in coal mines in Alabama and Tennessee until the 1940s, when the convict lease system was abolished by the federal government. Even though the convict lease system was abolished, prison labor is still threaded throughout our economy.
This is a contemporary story. We're in a contemporary moment that's built off of this legacy of extracting wealth from individuals who are negatively racialized as Black, but who are also poor and marginalized in other ways. It's all about extracting wealth, extracting humanity, and building wealth for private entities.
Exploitation is laid into the very foundation of the railroad tracks that carry coal to Hampton Roads, where coal dust continues to disproportionately burden Black residents because of where they live. So what happens on the other side of the mountain, where the coal comes from? Let's follow the tracks to one of the earliest American fossil fuel sources, West Virginia coal. I traced the coal that gets shipped out of Hampton Roads terminals back to about a dozen mines in West Virginia.
For many, coal and West Virginia are synonymous. Coal is abundant and cleaner than ever before.
The coal dust is just everywhere. It doesn't matter if there's a coal mine right next to you or if you just, you know, live here.
This is Junior Walk. He's an environmental advocate, and he lives next to a coal mine in the southern part of West Virginia in a tiny town named Eunice. I talked to Junior to get a sense of how coal companies treat people living there on the other end of the railroad tracks. Could you tell me about coal dust affecting your life personally?
The dust has always been a problem here. When they were first putting that mine in there, the dust was absolutely awful. I could literally put a record on my turntable and play it and then like leave it be for 24 hours and then try to play the same record again. And it wouldn't play because of how much dust had accumulated just in 24 hours. Yep. So I could imagine what the insides of my lungs look like.
Junior was a new volunteer with Coal River Mountain Watch, an environmental accountability group, when an explosion at the Upper Big Branch mine killed 29 people. The biggest coal mining disaster in recent American history. It was 2010.
Where were you when that happened?
I was trying to get to my home and I couldn't because the road was completely blocked. I was like, what's going on? Why are all these, you know, ambulances and stuff here? And I remember being real concerned because I had a cousin who was younger than me. He was 18 years old at the time, and he worked in that mines. Couldn't get a hold of nobody to figure out if he was in there, if he was all right or what. And sat there for like about an hour waiting to see what was up. Finally got a hold of somebody about it and figured out, you know, he was late for work that day. And that was the only thing that kept him from being in there.
Now, Junior is a watchdog for coal company environmental violations.
These companies, they will factor the fines and things like that that they get from these environmental problems into the cost of doing business. But What they don't is when we find something where we can force them to take workers and equipment away from actively mining coal to go back and fix something.
Junior and his group focus on environmental accountability as a way to directly disrupt the mining that has hurt them, because the legal system won't do that. For example, for the Upper Big Branch explosion, the companies were fined, and the CEO, Don Blankenship, went to prison for a year. But the mining continues. The year of the explosion, the mine's parent company, Alpha, paid a $209 million settlement on top of a $10.8 million fine. So what did the families think of this? One person who lost her brother said, "It wouldn't have mattered what happened in this courtroom today. It wouldn't have been enough."
Why is it that we prioritize that money that's being pulled out of that mountain and going into the pockets of the people who own that company and not the health and the longevity of them people who live down beside that coal mine?
Junior's white, but living in coal country, he sees and deals with something that Hampton Roads residents of color might recognize: the way health is pulled out of them at no cost to the corporations doing it. There are terrible, spectacular disasters like what happened at Upper Big Branch. But there's also the slow daily violence of coal dust, an unwelcome intruder in their lives, homes, and bodies. Further down the railroad, we can follow the coal to a community in Baltimore, where we will find the second largest coal export terminal in the country.
Just jumping in to remind you that you're listening to Making Contact. If you like today's show and want more information, or if you'd like to leave us a comment, visit us at our new website, focmedia.org. There you can access today's show and all of our prior episodes. And now, back to the show.
CSX is the name of the rail company that connects the railroad tracks outside Junior's window to the export terminals on the East Coast. CSX doesn't own all of the terminals it delivers to, but in Baltimore, it does own one in a neighborhood called Curtis Bay. The neighborhood's mostly poor and working class. It's surrounded by environmental hazards, including a medical waste incinerator, a landfill, gas and oil storage, as well as the CSX coal terminal. Residents have complained about the effects the terminal has on them for decades, including coal dust. But a few years ago, things came to a head.
December 13, 2021, an explosion at a CSX coal silo rocking Curtis Bay.
The explosion shook houses and blew out windows.
It spread coal into the air and into people's lungs.
The explosion happened during normal coal loading operations,
caused by a buildup of methane on the conveyor belt.
The blast could be felt miles away, some saying it felt like an earthquake and felt their building shake for a while.
I went outside and I said, "There's something going on at the coal pier."
Curtis Bay residents gave public comment following the explosion.
"I did smell, like everyone did, coal burning.
Sitting in my living room and being shaken in my chair with this loud boom. Nobody knew what to do.
It felt like someone picked up the house and dropped it back down. We demand CSX and everyone be held accountable for what they are doing to our communities."
Coal in Curtis Bay Terminal is stored both in silos as well as open piles. The dust in the silos is extremely explosive, and even a small spark can cause a chain reaction of detonations. The design of the facilities contributed to the explosion in 2021. They weren't being ventilated well enough, so the methane buildup caused the coal dust to explode, even though the facility passed prior inspections. A few months after the explosion, two Curtis Bay residents filed a class action lawsuit. It would require CSX to provide a $5 million medical fund for Curtis Bay residents for continuous exposure to coal dust.
This is Lucy. I'm just jumping in here to say that a federal judge has since approved a settlement by the rail company, but for the lower amount of $1.75 million. Okay, back to the story.
John Chinaman is a co-founder of Coal Kills Baltimore, a group that is demanding a clean and healthy environment in Curtis Bay.
We organize around the CSX coal piers in the Curtis Bay neighborhood in South Baltimore.
He described the consequences of the explosion for CSX.
In the wake of the coal pier explosion, the silo explosion, the state, along with CSX, came to an agreement that they would be fined $15,000 and give $100,000 to a local-based community organization. $15,000 state fine and $100,000 buy-off to a community group is not climate justice.
All of the fines issued to penalize CSX came from OSHA, the federal agency that oversees worker safety. None of the fines mentioned the health of the residents of the adjacent neighborhood. This accountability structure leaves a big hole when it comes to a lot of people who experienced harm due to the explosion and continue to be harmed by the coal dust.
I can remember taking a video where the dust was just blowing off of the piles.
This is Terrell Askew, John's co-organizer with Coal Kills Baltimore.
It wasn't an overly windy day, and it was just blowing off of the piles. One of the weirdest things about Curtis Bay is the coal pier is right across from a recreation center where there's a children's play area. Literally, they're right in the crosswinds of the coal piles.
In Curtis Bay, the silo explosion was a dazzlingly violent event. But coal dust is something residents deal with in a silent way every day. And that cumulative impact can be as significant as an explosion. It's just not as visible.
CSX doesn't care about the lives that they hurt. But then they're also part of a system, honestly, that sees lives being destroyed as the price of doing business.
You can throw as much money as possible at dressing things up and beautifying, but as long as the coal is blowing off the pier and polluting the bay and polluting the neighborhood, you've got a problem.
There are very straightforward ways for dust to be mitigated at sites like this one, like better ventilation, spraying the coal with water, or creating a physical barrier between the coal and the community, or between the coal and the wind. Coal dust is a choice by the company, in this case CSX, to forward the cost of that mitigation onto residents, who instead pay for it with their health and well-being. We followed the coal from the mountains to the shore. Now, we're arriving at our final stop, Hampton Roads, Virginia. Today, coal dust from the export terminals in Hampton Roads continues to disproportionately burden African American residents due to where they live. It's from the same coal seam in West Virginia that made the dust that clogged Junior Walk's record player, the same coal seam that made the dust that exploded inside the silo in Curtis Bay, Baltimore. The price that Black residents of Newport News and Norfolk pay for living next to the coal terminals is not conceptual or abstract. I asked Donquita Clements, a Newport News resident, what she pays annually in health costs just around the coal dust for herself and her children.
One thing that I notice in my own child is the two toddlers always have a cough. It's like they're stuffy every day. That's a daily fight. They've never been diagnosed with anything allergy-wise. When we lived in 23608, never had the problem.
23608 is the zip code for Uptown Newport News, miles away from the coal export terminal.
I feel like I probably buy congestion medicine at least twice a month.
In how much do you spend on that?
Ooh, about $150 a month.
How much do you spend on a ventilation system?
Ooh.
If you had to estimate.
To get the new one we got, it was $10,000.
That's about average for a new HVAC system.
And don't forget, you have to then separately get an AC unit that goes on the outside of your house.
Which is another
$300,000-$400,000. And our ventilation system, we noticed that where you put your filter at, it turns black every time we change it within about, you know how you're supposed to have it for like a month?
Mm-hmm.
Not even 2 weeks. So you have to make the investment to try to help yourself.
If you're just an individual, paying for all this gear to manage your health and air quality, it adds up fast. All that stuff Don Quita just mentioned, the filters, the ventilation system, plus the cough syrup for the lingering symptoms, it's like $14,000 down. Then another $250 to $350 a month, which is like $4,000 a year. And that doesn't count doctor's visits. It's good that these improvements are available to Don Quita and her family, though it's not fair that they have to pay for them. But most people in this neighborhood are not going to be able to afford this extra gear. These costs aren't being volunteered by Don Quita and her community. They're being extracted to build wealth for private companies. One way to look at this is to compare it to the accountability costs paid by coal and rail companies at the other places we visited this episode. At our first stop in West Virginia, Upper Big Branch Mine exploded in 2010. Alpha paid a total of a $209 million settlement, which was 5% of their revenue that year. By the way, Alpha is the same company that owns the majority of the Dominion Coal Terminal in Newport News. At our second stop in Baltimore, a silo exploded in the export terminal. CSX paid 0.3% of their annual profit in fines. That's three zeros on the other side of the decimal. CSX is the same rail company that ships to the export terminal in Newport News. The average income in Don Quita's zip code for Southeast Newport News is $39,000. Someone like Don Quita would be spending almost 10% of her total income on symptom management alone. But this isn't a completely fair comparison because Don Quita and her family don't benefit at all from the coal, unlike the corporations we're talking about. From the very foundations of the first tracks that were laid to ship West Virginia coal through Newport News and Norfolk, the costs of this industry have never been paid by those who profit the most. We can trace it back to John Henry's footprints in the dust under the first railroad tracks that shipped coal to Hampton Roads. The work that he was forced to do ended his life, but it brought the investor in charge of the project tremendous profit. Today, America's coal export system echoes the burdens placed on John Henry and his contemporaries by industry and by the state. These forces pulled labor and life out of them in order to lay the foundations for a major part of the fossil fuel economy. And now, from where coal originates in West Virginia to where it gets exported in Baltimore all the way to Hampton Roads, people continue to deal with poisoned land, water, and bodies. Invasions on a cellular level.
That was producer Adrian Wood with an excerpt from Episode 3 of Crosswinds, which was produced through the University of Virginia's Repair Lab. To learn more or to find out where to hear the whole series, go to our website at focmedia.org. And that does it for today's show. I'm Lucy Kang. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
Communication is everywhere, but what is it? Communication is how you share your thoughts, your opinions, your culture, from what you see on TV to what you post online. But what about the people who are not being seen or heard? AMI is a media company that strives to be a voice for Canadians with